The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Our topic today is healthcare innovation and channeling passion in a different way than traditional medicine, with the goal of empowering patients to take better care of themselves. I'm joined by Dr. Stacy Schmidt, who completed her undergraduate degrees at Xavier University of Louisiana, where she obtained a BS in chemistry in 2003. She completed her medical school at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta in 2007 and went on to train at the Emory J. Willis Hirsch Internal Medicine Residency Program. Upon completion of her residency in 2010, she joined the Division of General Internal Medicine at Emory University. Dr. Schmidt's interests include improving care delivery in a way that empowers patients to self-manage their health. She believes that effective care delivery requires patient-centered care that promotes self-efficacy, as well as enhanced communication between providers from various disciplines regarding the plan of care. Stacy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stacy, you've done a lot of innovative work around healthcare and helping patients live a healthier life, not just treating their medical problems and prescribing medications. Let me start by asking you to describe the setting that you work in, the types of patients that you see.
Yeah, so I work as medical director for a pretty large academic primary care center. We have over 130 residents who actually perform their continuity care in our center. It is a safety net hospital. We deal with a lot of vulnerable patient populations. I'd say at least 30 to 40% of our patients are uninsured. And that just brings a different set of health problems. Sometimes disease is a lot more advanced because people sometimes aren't receiving that primary care on the front end. And it's not until they're having a symptom that they come in and then we identify what the issues are. Because, again, it's a pretty large uninsured population, a lot of our patients deal with kind of some of these social determinants that we speak about in the literature. So things like food insecurity or housing issues or even unemployment, which a lot of times is a big reason for being uninsured. And those, again, if you're dealing with those challenges, you know, thinking about paying for your medicines and taking them every day on time, takes a backseat, a big backseat to the other things of just keeping a roof over your head and making sure that there's food on the table for your kids. So that's what we mean when we say a vulnerable population. We basically mean that there are many other things on the minds of some of our patients that should take precedence, and health sometimes takes a back seat because you just don't have the time or the bandwidth to really focus on that when there's so many other things that you are trying to address.
Yeah, and as a result of the challenges that your patients face, what types of health issues do you commonly see?
Yeah, so the bread and butter, I'm a primary care doctor in general medicine. Our bread and butter, I'd say, is kind of diabetes, hypertension, heart failure, arthritis, COPD, and obesity. And so many of these things are, believe it or not, just related to healthy behaviors, which, again, if you are really just trying to keep food on the table, you may not be as interested in making sure you've had your 5 or 10 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables a day. But the truth is that what you eat really does play into those chronic diseases. And so we deal with a lot of managing those things.
Yeah. And you mentioned food insecurity. Can you explain how that plays in to taking care of your patients and how prevalent it is?
Oh, boy. So in Atlanta, and I'm probably off on my numbers, but in Atlanta, overall, food insecurity, which is defined as worrying that you are not going to be able to afford food in a month's time that you may run out of money and not have enough left to fully feed your family for the entire month. That is, the prevalence of it is, I think, about in the teens, somewhere in the teens for Atlanta overall. We studied it in our patient population, and it's more like 50% of our patients. So food insecurity is huge. And I remember naively thinking that you couldn't have a food desert. A food desert is defined as, I believe, a two-mile radius, not having access to healthy produce or a grocery store within a two-mile radius of your home. And I remember thinking, like, there's no food desert in an urban city, you know, heavily populated city. That's probably in the suburbs or the countryside. But the truth is that there are plenty of food deserts in Atlanta. There's plenty in New Orleans, which is where I grew up, by that definition. And if you don't have a car or really great sidewalks, it's going to be really hard for you to travel beyond a two-mile radius to kind of get access to healthy foods. So it's really, really prevalent for our patients. And that, in turn, causes you to eat lots of unhealthy things, a lot of fast food, a lot of deli meat. There might be a corner store nearby which carries potato chips and lots of processed things. And if there is a little produce, there's not a lot of variety, and often it's rotten because, again, it's from a gas station or a corner store. And so you just don't have the access that maybe other people do in neighborhoods.
Yeah, I mean, those are pretty striking numbers, given that, as you said, we are in an urban setting. Mm-hmm. And another, you know, possible misconception is that food insecurity travels with unemployment, but there are a lot of employed people.
Oh, yes.
Yes. What do you see there regarding people who are working that may be in a poverty level?
Yeah, so I also learned this. We in some of our work, we've worked alongside the Atlanta Community Food Bank, which is a lovely organization, really trying to end hunger in Atlanta. I really want my daughter to kind of know about these things too. So we brought our Girl Scout troop to visit with them once and talk about it. And one thing they highlighted, which I never really, I think I knew it, but it took them having to talk about it, was the working poor. That I think a lot of times we assume people who are homeless are dealing with food insecurity, or people who are unemployed. That just seems to make intuitive sense. But that there's actually a huge population of working poor people who make enough money where they don't really qualify for SNAP benefits, but they don't make enough to really make ends meet and have enough food on the table throughout that month for their paycheck. And those are actually, and children, believe it or not, children are very heavily affected by this because their parents are in this situation where they're kind of the working poor and just making enough to pay the house bill and the electricity and these other things. And so food, having three solid, nutritious meals a day is not available to them.
Yeah, and working with the population and seeing these challenges, it's inspired you to really try and address a lot of these issues and help people more than, as we said in the beginning, than traditional healthcare of just going to the doctor, getting a prescription can do, because clearly with these social determinants of food insecurity playing such a big part of health, a prescription doesn't really address some of these underlying problems. So tell me a little bit about your aha moment.
My aha moment was probably as a third year resident and first year faculty member, where I just felt we had 20 minutes to see a patient, manage their five or six uncontrolled conditions. I mean, it wasn't uncommon for one patient to have uncontrolled hypertension, uncontrolled diabetes, obesity, arthritis as a result, obstructive sleep apnea, now heart failure because of that, in just one patient. And we had 20 minutes to kind of address this. And you were just I say slapping Band-Aids on the issue. You know, let's increase your blood pressure medicine. Let's put you on some insulin. And honestly, again, when you're dealing with all these other financial challenges, even the ability to afford and pick up those medicines and take them daily is a challenge. So I found myself prescribing a ton of medicines, knowing wholeheartedly that there was a decent percentage of my patients who weren't even going to be able to take them. But the real issue was, if I could just get this person access to healthy food and encourage them to eat healthier, we could like put a dent in all five of these issues. And they'd probably become better controlled just by virtue of eating a healthier diet and living a healthier lifestyle. And how do we even do that? And goodness knows I can't do it in a 20-minute visit. So I actually approached my mentor and boss about the idea of doing group classes where we could have time. I could have a full hour to dive in on a topic and invite a group of patients to hear about it and discuss it. And maybe that would be a way to kind of slowly get to the root cause of so many of these chronic illnesses.
And as a result of that, what came next?
Yeah, so she encouraged me. Emory has a lot of internal grants that you can apply for, which is lovely. I mean, it's a smaller grant. It's not nearly as rigorous as an NIH grant, for example, in terms of writing. So for a junior young faculty member, it's much less overwhelming and daunting. And, of course, the pool of applicants is going to be a lot smaller because it's all internal. So she encouraged me to apply for one of the internal faculty grants to do this, and it afforded me about 25% protected time to really dive into a research project, which for me was just this innovation of leading and hosting group classes. And because my time was protected, I could volunteer to actually teach and lead them and not be worried about what the revenue would be or the billing and all these other things. And it was just lovely to be able to kind of start from the ground up to design a curriculum that I thought met patients' needs and questions, and then be able to actually deliver it and really uncover how to tweak it. You know, was I really hitting the topics my patients wanted? I found out I wasn't, right? There were so many much simpler. I was there initially talking about the Mediterranean diet and the low-fat diet, all these things which are really great things that people should know. But I uncovered that for some of my patients, just knowing the basic four food groups was a challenge. And we needed to just start much lower than where I thought the bar needed to be set, at least initially. And then maybe you could dive into some of these topics in more detail at a later point.
How well received were these classes?
You know, I will say that I think well received. Of course,
I'm
probably a little biased. I will say historically, and it's been helpful to talk to other, you know, group classes are now kind of something that I think lots of institutions are diving into. So Kaiser does them, WellStar, I believe. I may be misspeaking. But I think there are lots of places that buy into this concept. And in talking with other people as I've kind of been more and more in this space, group classes are not well attended, just generally speaking. We would invite upwards of 30 people to sometimes have 6 or 7 show. And that's probably for a myriad of reasons. I think historically, we think of the patient-doctor relationship as a one-on-one and an intimate setting. Some people are not comfortable really talking about their health issues openly with a whole group of people. I think sometimes being put on the spot in front of a group can shy some people away. On top of that, at least when I was doing the grant, these were free classes. Now that the grant is over and we're still doing them, if a physician is leading them, there's a copay involved. So that also is a deterrent. And these classes are weekly, which, again, for people who are dealing with all of these social determinants, can be really hard to attend if you don't have a car and you're paying MARTA. It's just, it can be a lot. So I think there's a ton of reasons why they're not as well attended. That said, it sounds like across other healthcare systems, this is about the show rate that group classes will have. And so it's nice to see that even for a more vulnerable patient population, attendance was about where it is across health systems that have a larger proportion of insured patients with income and employment and other things. So I think it has been really well received. And one thing I learned, again, by doing this, I would go to classes initially with a full curriculum ready to talk, and patients would raise their hands and ask completely off-topic questions, right? Which as a young, eager faculty member, I'd say, we'll get to that later. I'll address that at the end of class. I got to finish this curriculum I spent an hour putting together. And over time, I realized, you know what? These questions that people are asking are if they're bringing it up in class, it's important to them. And even if it's about some mythical diet, you know, does eating cranberries really help or drinking vinegar water really make me lose weight, whatever it was, that we needed to just stop and talk about that. And so over time, I became much more open to just completely going off topic and stopping what my agenda was to address whatever the patient's agenda was. And I found that to be a much better way to dialogue and really engage the group than if I just stayed completely on topic with what I had planned. And so that was probably my favorite part of the group class, is just allowing it to morph into whatever was on the minds of my patients. And really trying, and somehow I would find a way to weave in some basic points, you know. For me, repetition was key. And so if I could just talk about my food plate and like half of your plate needed to be vegetables and somehow weave that one point into whatever questions they brought up, I felt that it was a good class.
The thing, eat your vegetables. That's great. And it started as a class, but the program itself has evolved, right?
That is correct. I'm really excited to say, and you know, I certainly can't speak into the granular details of this because there's so many people involved who are helping to shape the future of it. But this has evolved now into a food as medicine program that we are really trying to develop at our hospital. And it started in many ways. I think, interestingly, sometimes the universe really aligns when it's time for something to happen. I think there are interesting, you get put in touch with the right people and find out that, oh, so-and-so in this space was also talking about something similar, and it just leads to this synergistic effect. But essentially, about a year or two into the healthy living class, we had a colleague from the CDC who had actually done her residency at Emory, and who reached out and said, listen, you know, the CDC is really interested in trying to promote healthier eating and fruits and vegetables, and Wholesome Wave Georgia is really leading this fruit and vegetable prescription program that free food and access to healthy produce all through philanthropic funding and grant funding, and they'd be willing to actually provide these free foods to patients. We just need a physician and a health system willing to kind of provide the prescriptions. I said, sign me up. We have this healthy living class. We'd be happy to provide these prescriptions there. And so the healthy living class was actually the first pilot for about 30 patients to begin receiving these fruit and vegetable prescriptions. And simultaneously, unbeknownst to me at the time, but simultaneously, the Atlanta Community Food Bank was in touch with our hospital system about how to really address and end hunger. And they knew that a lot of the vulnerable patients in zip codes that they had identified as areas of real hunger and food insecurity were served by our county hospital system. And so they were speaking to some of our administrative constituents in the system about how we can really leverage the health system to end hunger and to address food as a real need for health. And I think the struggle at that time was what does that look like within a healthcare system? But interestingly, the Atlanta Community Food Bank, you know, has done their research with patients, and it sounds like even though they may have access to a food pantry and patients and may know about a food pantry, that actually the rate of showing up and picking up food from the pantry was, I believe it was about 12%, something in the teens, if I'm not mistaken. Again, my numbers might be a little bit off. And in talking with, you know, with patients and it sounds like, you know, some people don't want there to be this association that, I'm not sure what the right word is, that there's charity involved, or I'm not sure how, because again, I'm extrapolating here, so I wonder what words patients would actually use with that. But people wanted to kind of be self-sufficient, and the thought was, if we could link this or embed this somehow into healthcare as just what we do to be healthy, as opposed to, you need help, let me tell you about this off-site food pantry, that maybe it would really be better understood and embraced by physicians and patients alike. But I think at the time that these conversations were happening, it was unclear what that looks like in a health system, you know? And so it's really lovely to hear that, you know, at this point we are thinking about opening an on-site food pharmacy. And I think the title of that is really lovely, that we're not saying a food pantry. This isn't something that just people who need help have to go to, right? This is a pharmacy, a place where you can go to become healthy, and it's open to all. And I really love that concept. I think it could be a huge paradigm shift in terms of how we think about giving our patients access to food and healthy lives.
You know, I love so many of the terms you used. You know, pretty remarkable that you've gone from prescribing a lot of medications for a lot of conditions in a short office visit to prescribing a food prescription, and even more remarkable of incorporating it in healthcare. You know, this concept of food pharmacy, you know, just imagining that it's a pharmacy stocked with produce instead of pill bottles. And you see your doctor writes a prescription for food, you walk into this pharmacy, shelf stocked with produce, you pick up your prescription, and then there's the, you know, application part. So for patients who now have, you know, a bag full of fresh produce, you know, there's a lot of skill involved, right? To what do you do with that and not let it go to waste for someone who's been eating fast food? Now you've got to do something with fresh produce. So what has evolved to help with the application part?
Really good question. I always joke. So another innovative thing we did in the Healthy Living class prior to kind of all of this was we worked with an organization, we still do, called Open Hand Atlanta, and there are dietitians who work there. I hope she wouldn't mind me saying her name. I had the lovely opportunity to work with Joy Getz in particular, and she, Open Hand, offers free cooking demonstrations to show you how to cook healthy foods. And then, of course, you get to eat it, which was always my favorite part. So we organized Joy to come to the Healthy Living classes, I think once a month, and I always tell the story. It's a true story about how I never knew how to prepare a pomegranate. You know, I had no idea. And so I heard pomegranates are healthy for you, all these antioxidants, which can fight cancer and heart disease and stroke. And I was like, I have no idea how to prep this thing. They're also not the cheapest fruit in the world, let me just say. But she showed us how to do it. You cut it in half with a knife. It looks so hard. I was afraid to even try to cut it, but you cut it, and then you put it in a bowl of water, and you can just break open the shell and just kind of wiggle out the seeds, and the seeds float to the bottom, and the white pieces that are supposed to be discarded float to the top of the water, so it becomes very easy to just kind of get rid of the part that you discard. And I'm not kidding. That is now why I eat pomegranates. Like, had I not had her demo that, I still to this day would not buy them, because I would have no idea what to do with them. And so I think the application is huge. You have to learn how to, like, develop these skills. And so part of this food as medicine program, part of what we did with the first fruit and vegetable prescription pilot within the Healthy Living classes, and now more broadly within this food as medicine program, is to have a teaching kitchen where you not only pick up your produce, but you get to practice with it and learn how to cook. And at least in the current, I'm not sure what the future will look like, but with the cooking classes we did in the past, there were also free incentives. You went home with a box of cutting knives. You went home with measuring cups. The graduating gift, I think, for that first pilot class was crock pots. I mean, there are literally people who have houses who may not have gas or a working stove, you know, and so they need those utensils and ways to actually be able to get home and do the cooking. So I thought that that was really, and this was all through, again, philanthropic and funds and grant funding, but patients really learned the skills and then went home with the utensils they needed to implement them.
Yeah, just remarkable seeing the progression of the program. Initially, when you started the class, you mentioned that you'd invite 30 people with the plan to have this food pharmacy. What's the projected number of lives you think you'd be able to touch?
Yeah, so the I might be off in my numbers. It's in the thousands, the low thousands, but it is over 1,000 for sure that we plan to touch in any given month, I believe. So it's planned to start with uncontrolled diabetic patients, so those with an A1C greater than 9%, and we want to kind of start there and then see where that takes us. I have a feeling, in terms of just knowing of other health systems that have implemented food pharmacies, whatever you project, it winds up being a lot more than that. So I believe it was Boston Medical Center. I may be off, but I remember one reading that the projection was 700 people served in a month, and it's something like 7,000 now. You know, I mean, it's just exponentially bigger than what was anticipated. So I think it's a little hard to know how many people we will impact. But any is a starting point in my mind. And if it can just help them make the case of, hey, we started, projecting to serve this many. There's this many waiting, you know, on a reservation list who want to do this. And it can just even help, hopefully, make the case for expanding the program and moving to larger populations.
Wow, it's remarkable what you've done. What are your personal plans? What's your vision? What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, you know, definitely just impacting lives, right? And helping people to realize that I just think we've gotten so far away from what health really means in healthcare, right? And so much of our dollars and time investment and research is about cures for things. And I think if we just started to invest that same amount of research and dollars towards how you can prevent, and this is, of course, coming from a primary care doctor, my main interest is in
preaching to the choir.
It's in prevention, right? That we wouldn't even need to get to the point where we have to think about cures. Cures should be thought about for things like cancer that no matter what you do, you have no control over. Our genetic illnesses, right? That you just, there's no control. But things like diabetes and hypertension, these are things that we really shouldn't even be dealing with if we had invested the time and the energy to kind of make sure people had these basic skills, the knowledge, the skill set, and the resources, right? Some of it is there are neighborhoods that don't even have the resources to get healthy food, and people don't know how to grow it from the ground and manage that. So I think, of course, I would love to see this program be successful, and definitely will be investing time and energy for food as medicine. On a larger scale, I think just getting into the space of helping our legislators and society as a whole know of really what people are dealing with, what some of our most vulnerable patients are really struggling with, and opening our eyes to that and thinking about surely there has to be a way that we can figure out how to address these needs and still generate revenue for our economy and still be sure that we have robust education systems and neighborhoods. I just think we haven't invested the time and energy into really thinking about what that could look like, but certainly it has to be profitable. We just haven't tapped into how it can be or really done the projections to think about that. But I'd really love to continue to broaden discussions about social determinants, whether that be food insecurity or unemployment or education, but to just help make the case of how all these things really do play into health, and everybody has a right to health. And if we can just kind of fight and get people there, we'd be doing a really good thing for our society.
Well, Stacy, thank you so much for all the incredible work you're doing. You've already made a difference, and sure you will continue doing so as you continue working towards your goals. Is there anything you'd like to share that we haven't gotten to so far?
I think the last thing I would just bring up is the beauty of action planning and goal setting with patients, which, again, is something else I think we don't really touch on or learn a ton about in medical school. I think the pendulum is swinging. We're starting to talk about motivational interviewing and ways to communicate with patients that's truly shared decision-making. But health does not have to be black and white. I often tell my patients, and I fell into this issue as well, where I'd feel like I had to have an hour to work out. And if I couldn't find an hour in my day, then I couldn't do it at all. And it's really not that. It's not that black and white. If you can do 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there, you've done something. And it's about really increasing someone's confidence by starting small and starting with something someone truly feels they can do, so that they gain that self-efficacy and confidence to kind of want to try to set the bar a little bit higher. And if you keep working in that capacity, where you should help patients to set really low-hanging fruit types of goals, you over time can really move that needle a long way. But if you set that bar too high and start with something hard and really unachievable that just demotivates someone and overwhelms them, you won't move the needle at all. And I think that that is something we really need to start educating, and especially our primary care, people who are at the forefront of prevention. That's huge. And teaching our providers and our patients how to work together to set those goals, and then to think about the barriers. So for me, I use lots of different examples, but I love to cite a study. I talk about it with patients. You know, there was a study that looked at candy eating, and they put a bowl of candy on the table in some office space for a person, and then there was another office space where the bowl of candy was in a cabinet with the door closed. And of course, the one where the candy is right there in front of you, the person ate like 70% more candy than the person who had it in a cabinet. And so simple things to overcome barriers that you can talk about with your patients, like if you know you love candy, I'm not even saying you can't buy it, because I know that that's just too hard and unachievable for you. I'm just suggesting, could we put it in a place that just makes it a little bit more difficult to get to? And asking the patient, where is that in your house? Is it your basement? Is it some cabinet way high where you have to get like your footstool to grab it? What does that look like for you? And let's just talk about maybe keeping your candy there as a starting point and seeing if you tend to eat a little bit less because it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. So goal setting and then thinking about the barriers and helping patients devise little, you know, tricks to kind of overcome their barriers. I love teaching that. I think we could go a long way with really discussing that more for our med students, our nurses, and our allied health professions. So that's one little pearl I'd like to leave everyone with.
Oh, it is a really important one. Stacy, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.